Oh, Wallace, BA in English, California State University in Los Angeles. He's been a member of Sunstone Foundation, National Advisory Board, for a good number of years, and one of our most supportive members. We will begin with a short presentation of the subject that I would like to introduce. And then we'll follow the order in which I introduced the panel. It was really striking when I noted that the new encyclopedia on Mormonism did not even contain the word sustain, when in fact it's one of the most prevalent activities we engage in on a weekly basis. As an aside, you will note, however, that follow the brethren is found there. Now, my remarks are going to be kind of a potpourri of some thoughts. I got interested in this subject many, many years ago when I was exploring the primitive church in an effort to find out whether there were things that we did today that were not engaged in the primitive church, or vice versa. And I came across the concept of the doctrine of common consent. Now, sustain is of modern usage, of course, in the Church of Jesus Christ. Anciently, it was spoken of in democratic terms as the doctrine of common consent, or more precisely, as the priesthood of all the faithful. After the Restoration, priesthood of all the faithful was actually discontinued by Cyprian in the third Christian century, to help to bring some peace to the church and the empire. And it was restored somewhat by Martin Luther. And after that, it was called the priesthood of all believers. That term did not become part of the Restoration. However, the doctrine of sustaining did. And but I want to, for purposes of education, I want to talk about the primitive concept of the doctrine of common consent, or the priesthood of all the faithful. Just a few short paragraphs of a paper I've done on called The Political Outlines of the Persecution of the Primitive Church. Christianity's emergence from obscurity introduced to the Roman world the democratic idea of decision-making by common consent. The concept of power in the people, as embodied in the priesthood of all the faithful, was the basic and the essential administrative power of the Church of Jesus Christ for nearly 200 years. During this period, the Church consisted of isolated and widely scattered congregations of Christians. Each congregation was presided over by a bishop, with the laity exercising an active role in the selection of church officers and in the administration of church affairs. The universal priesthood of all the faithful was very real to the early Christians. By conversion and entrance into the Christian church, all believers, men and women, received the priesthood, and with it were given, and I quote, a part and a lot in the life and work of the church. I will not give you the references. The layman had certain essential duties to perform, and that these ministrations were reserved for them alone. Ecclesiastical sovereignty among Christians, i.e. priesthood, lay upon the shoulders of the laity and was their direct responsibility, thus making the congregation of the faithful the supreme authority within the church. The far-reaching importance of the principle of common consent and the exercise of the congregational's priesthood is to be noted in the fact that, and I quote, the primitive bishops were considered only as the first of their equals and the honorable servants of a free people. End of quote. Whenever a vacancy occurred in the bishopric by death or apostasy, a new one was chosen from among the presbyters by the suffrage of the whole congregation, every member of which supposed himself invested with a sacred and sacerdotal character. The all-pervading nature and character of the sacerdotal authority is summed up by Eastwood, and I quote, "The doctrine of the priesthood of all believers is directly connected with the high priesthood of Christ, the layman's ordinances, the authority of the whole congregation, the Eucharist, the offering of the spiritual sacrifice, the concept of the church as a high priestly race, and the priesthood of all just men, the unity of the church, questions of discipline, the believer's access to the Father, and the church's missionary task." End of quote. Commenting on the universality of the priesthood and its sovereignty residing in the congregations of the primitive church, Lindsay provides this significant conclusion. If the whole people were priests, and if the main thought in priesthood was authority, and the supremacy in judging in all matters of rule and discipline, then the people, the congregation, were the rulers in the last resort. If the first and foremost, end quote, incidentally. In the first and foremost, if the first and foremost doctrine of Christianity was the saviorhood of Jesus of Nazareth, then the second most important doctrine was the idea that men and women, by their nature, should be free to rule themselves. The very essence of the principle of priesthood of all believers is not only that men and women should govern themselves, but that they were in fact capable of self-government. Now that has ruminated and floated around in my head for many years, and recent events in which prominent members of our association have been attacked by members within our church in high places caused me to put together this panel. I would like to see us explore here this evening the whole notion of what one you sustain. Does it make a difference if you're sustaining a primary president? Do you think any of the brethren that have been dealt with by high authority would have been so dealt with had they had differences with the primary president? Should it make a difference who you're sustaining? And so not only do we want to look at the etymological meaning of the word sustain, but we want to look at it also in terms of not only a noun but an active verb and what it is that you do when you sustain. I've yet to hear a sermon on the subject. I don't know of any missionary instruction on the subject. I don't know of any incident in priesthood or Sunday school manuals where we have actually come to grips with the issue, nor has it been discussed in the many forums that I have been in within this church since I was baptized a member at the age of 16. I think it's time now that we take a look at this word, and I've asked my assistants and my panelists here to come forward now and give us their thoughts on it. I really intended this to be a round table, but they didn't set it up that way. I really wanted us to get all of us involved in this thing, but they have other priorities here at the Symphony. Okay. We are going to have plenty of time to do it if I've put this together carefully enough. And with that now, we'll hear from Bruce Young.
I think about half of what I'm going to say will relate to the topic. The other half will be the things that I use this as an excuse to talk about, and I suppose that's an appropriate thing to do here. First, I wanted to reflect on why I'm here. I find that Sunstone is one of the places I get to meet my friends, especially the ones from back east and so on. I have a few chosen places where I do that, including, Temple Square, I forget what the other ones are. There's a short list I have that I'm pretty sure I'll bump into somebody I know. But I was asked to be here, and I didn't volunteer, and I wondered who turned my name in for that and why I was chosen. It was Phil. Oh, no, okay. I assumed it might have been Gene England, because he's always volunteering me for all sorts of things. He doesn't have time to do himself, or who knows? I'll have to investigate that and see what really happened. But I suppose that I represent, I'm supposed to maybe represent, I don't know, maybe I'm sort of on the, I don't know what the right adjective would be, the traditional wing, maybe that's what I represent. I teach at BYU after all. Of course, so does my brother, who is also active here and represents the other wing, but, you know, there are all sorts of things we can represent. But I don't want to be pigeonholed. I just want to say what I feel, and I'm going to try to share what some of my thoughts are about this whole matter of sustaining. Now, first of all, the first thing that occurred to me was, well, gee, this is kind of interesting. Somebody's asking me, I'm down there at BYU teaching, someone's asking me to come and participate in Sunstone. Of course, I managed to do it one way or another just about every year, but is there anything implicit here about the question of whether I should, whether it's whether I would be sustaining the brethren or not by simply coming here? Well, I'll just tell you my own view, and it's my personal view, and that is that if I have read the statements from, I guess it was the First Presidency, if I believed that they didn't want me to be here, I wouldn't be here. But I don't think that's what they meant, and so I'm here. My interpretation of what was said is that it was very particular kinds of things that are associated with temple covenants and with undermining the purposes of the church or whatever, that I don't feel that I'm doing any of that. And if I believed I would believe I was doing something wrong, and so I wouldn't do it. So, anyway, it wasn't a hard decision to come here. Now, as for what sustaining means, I've been obsessed for the last couple of years with a French-Lithuanian philosopher named Emmanuel Levinas. There may be one or two of you here who have heard of him, and probably because you took a class from me. He is a friend of Jacques Derrida, if that gives anything away. He was a student of Husserl and Heidegger, and anyway, follows in that tradition. But what makes him different is that he puts priority on the ethical relationship. His views have sometimes been called ethical postmodernism. So I'm really interested in this guy, and I've read his stuff. I'm teaching a class called Shakespeare and Levinas right now, in fact. So I thought, well, since he has the key to everything, maybe there's something he'll have to say about what it means to sustain. And what I'm going to suggest by just reading a couple of very obscure and hard-to-follow sentences here is that probably what it means to sustain is what it means to be human, what it means to be, simply. Levinas argues that we are not self-enclosed, self-sufficient, self-subsistent selves in the Western philosophical tradition, but that our very being is made possible by our relation with what he calls the other, which means the other person. And not only with just one other, but with all others, and with the entire world, in fact. And so what he says, to be a subject, to be a person, is to be literally subjected to all that is. And here are his obscure sentences. It is as resting on a self, supporting the whole of being, that being is assembled into a unity of the universe, and essence is assembled into an event. The self is a subjectum. It is under the weight of the universe, responsible for everything. The unity of the universe is not what my gaze embraces in its unity of apperception, but rather what is incumbent on me from all sides, regards me, what regards me in two senses of the term, accuses me, is my affair. So he's talking about, I'll try not to get into too much of this philosophical lingo, but he's talking about a kind of primordial passivity and responsibility that makes us human. That is that we sustain what is around us. So, in a way, he says, it's not a question of whether we choose to do that or not. That is our condition. Our choice is what we do about that. He said that in another place, it was necessary that the good choose me in order that I be able to choose it, that is, welcome its choice. That is, that I am not an utterly, absolutely free agent who does anything that I want. I am called upon to respond to what is before me, and I can respond either by taking that responsibility in Levinas's terms, serving the other, or trying to cut myself off from that response, either through ignoring, through hatred, through murder, through any number of things. So, that first of all is, I think, what sustaining means. Now, obviously, I'm using it in a very general sense, but I'm trying to lead in a particular direction. Now, one more thing from this fellow Levinas, and then I'll move on and try to say the rest of what I have to say. Someone introducing a book about Levinas says, taking up philosophy's central tradition, Levinas raises anew the question of the limits and nature of knowledge, the question of the status of thought itself. What is unique about Levinas's answer is that it binds thought not in the name of the true, but in the name of the good. Levinas does not demand that thought be more rigorous or more in tune with being, but that it be more thoughtful, heedful of the social and therefore moral conditions that govern it. Levinas demands that thought be humble. So I'm thinking that maybe sustaining has something to do with thought rather than being, as he calls it, murderous and usurpatory, tyrannous, attempting to take over and control and possess everything around it, that thought be humble. That it not take itself to be the be-all and end-all. Well, I got involved a few years ago with a book called A Thoughtful Faith. Some of you know that. It's edited by Phil, who's back there, Phil Barlow, and has about half of the authors are in this room, probably. But one of the essays here is by Carlfred Broderick, and many of you know who he is. And he talked about an experience where he felt put down by a church authority who had misunderstood him and so on, but worked his way through it and eventually came to feel that it was for the best, Carlfred had not understood the situation fully, and that he hadn't understood what was going on, and that it was good that he'd been patient and faithful through all of that. We're told in one of the sections of the Doctrine and Covenants to ask the people to receive Joseph Smith and what he said as if from God himself, in all patience and faith. Now, faith there is pretty obvious, but patience. Why would it require patience? Well, I suspect Joseph Smith could be irritating sometimes. Is that possible? Maybe anecdotal evidence of that. Brigham Young, certainly. But for some reason, we're asked to respond as if from God himself, in all patience, patiently putting up with maybe some of what we have to put up with in the process. Leonard Arrington, in one of his books, one of his many books, told of an early member of the church in Salt Lake, I think he was a bishop possibly, who was in having a conflict with Brigham Young and felt that there were problems and was struggling with that a great deal. And then he had a dream in which he saw the Savior, and the Savior took him in his arms and said, be patient, all will be made right, continue faithful, something to that effect. And that struck me as well, that if I'd been living under the time of Brigham Young, that maybe I would have had a few struggles and with some of what he did or said, and yet to bear that, to sustain that in patience and faith. Two other quick things, and I'm not sure how much time I've taken, about 10 minutes so far, I think. It's been suggested that on the basis of historical study, maybe the church should be a democracy. And that has sometimes been argued by apologists for the church, that we are one. But one of the best articles in this book, by Philip Barlow himself, suggests that the genius of the church lies not in its being simply a lay church or a hierarchical church, but a marvelous, almost paradoxical combination of both. And I think there's real truth to that. And it seems to me that that is... my own reading of the scriptures indicates that that's the way it's intended to be. Of course, a lot of the problem has to do with the abuses that can come with authority, even if that is divinely established. And obviously there are cautions in Doctrine and Covenants 121 in the New Testament, let he who would be first among you be the servant of all, that suggest how we need to use authority when we have it. I would suggest that we first of all take those scriptures as cautions to ourselves. Let ourselves be called into question rather than using those scriptures as a bludgeon against others. And yet there may be times when situations are such that we feel real harm is being done, and we may feel called upon to help others by calling into question those who are misusing authority. My own belief is that that should be done in the way that the Savior and the Doctrine and Covenants suggest. Go first to him who has offended thee and tell him face to face, and perchance thou wilt win thy brother in that way. And only after that, only after the serious and sincere attempt to confront someone else, should you, I think, go use other means. I know that that's something that Gene England has often recommended, because he's often had people not go to him face to face when they've been offended with him and they've gone to someone else and complained. He's of the view, and I'm of the view, that if we do go to others face to face when they have offended us, we may find that the offense was not entirely one-sided, and that we need to be open to that possibility, that we may be wrong. As Oliver Cromwell, I think, told Parliament at one point, "I beseech you in the bowels of Christ to consider the possibility that you might be wrong." One last thing to close, and that is that I've kind of led up to this by referring to this book, but I have an essay in here too, and I think it's pretty good, so if you haven't read it, please do. But I just want to read one little passage from it. And I might modify this now if I were to write it again, but basically this essay compares my own courtship and marriage to my struggles with religious faith and sees a lot of parallels between the two, and that's what it explores. And as I get here toward the end, I talk about how it seems to me that conflict in marriage is very similar to conflict in the church. And here's how I put it. "Another striking parallel between marriage and religious experience is the antagonism that too often mars both. In both instances, the antagonism usually springs from fears and dark fantasies, which, as they lead to resentment and hostility, create the very evidence they claim to be based on. Having experienced such self-created conflict, I am struck by how closely critics of the church," and let's just say people struggling or whatever, "with the church, resemble people upset with their marriage partners. There is, for both the critics and the dissatisfied spouses, the same combination of inexorable logic and essential blindness." I'm drawing on my own experience being upset in my own marriage, by the way, here. "Everything they see seems obvious to them, and indeed, even with the heavy role played by imagination, there is usually some evidence that can bear the interpretation they give. But, anesthetized to their own faults, hypersensitive to the imperfections of others, they do not see the real and potential splendor in the one or the many with whom they are yoked. The dark things they see are too often the products of their own hearts, and the evidence of a spouse's willingness to love and give, like the abundant evidence of God's love and active presence in his church, is easily ignored or forgotten." Now, I don't want to minimize problems, but I honestly believe, from the little that I know, that people in the church are basically people of goodwill, and that if we don't approach others in a fighting attitude, we're less likely to receive a hostile response. Thank you.
Well, one of the more trite ways to approach a subject like this, where we've been given the concept of sustain, of course, is to go to the dictionary and look it up and see what the formal definition is. And I didn't do that. But being something of an etymology buff, I have made a hazardous guess about what the etymology would say. And if any of you know for certain that I'm wrong, I hope you'll correct me. But what I think is the etymology here is that the S-U-S comes to us from the Latin sub, probably through the French sous, and the T-A-I-N is from tenir, to hold, is my guess. If that's the case, then what sustain means is that we hold from underneath, that we hold somebody up. And I think that's what it means. Now, to me, that implies a couple of things, like you might be able to hold them up while still kind of giving them an occasional poke or jab or needle from the bottom. And if you're really limber and in good shape, you might even be able to reach up there with a toe and give them a little kick once in a while. Without essentially destroying the upholding that you're trying to do. Enough on etymology. I think operationally what this means to me when I raise my hand in a meeting of the church to sustain somebody, whether a general authority or a primary president, what that means to me is that I'm affirming the legitimacy of that person's appointment. That I don't necessarily approve of that appointment in the sense that that's the choice I would have made. I don't necessarily approve of the appointment in the sense that I think it's the best person that might have been chosen for the job. But I do approve of the appointment in the sense that I think that the people making the appointment, the leaders making the appointment, had the right and authority to make that selection. And that I can't think of any reason bearing upon the person's good intentions, goodwill, or worthiness that would disqualify them from taking that, accepting that appointment and functioning in that position. And so that's what runs through my head when I raise my hand to sustain somebody, that I think that they have been called and appointed legitimately. It doesn't necessarily mean a lot of those other things. It doesn't even necessarily mean that I think this is the person and the only person that could have been picked by God. Because I think most of the appointments that are made in the church are appointments sort of like what happens when we get married, to follow and maybe Bruce's analogy. I hope all of us are old enough that none of us any longer believes, if we ever did, that the person we married was the one and only person that ever we could have married and had an acceptable relationship with, or that this was the person whom the Lord Himself picked out for us to marry. If you believe that, I got a bridge I'd like to try to sell you. But what I hope we do believe is that among the people that we might have married, there are a whole bunch that we could have had a successful marriage with, that a variety of circumstances have brought us together with this particular person. And we have a certain set of problems in that relationship, and the marriage is all about working those problems through for years and years and years, and you've all been there and you know what I mean. If we'd married somebody else, we might have gotten along just as well on balance, but we would maybe have had a different set of problems to work through. Well, I think that callings in the church are very much like that. I don't think for a minute that there are very many people called as apostles or bishops or stake presidents who could not have equally well been replaced by somebody else called at that same time to that same position and worked out just as well. In other words, I'm saying that I think most of the time when people are called to positions and we're asked to sustain them, the Lord doesn't really care very much whether it was that person or some other person that was called. As long as the person is called legitimately and it's a person who will make some effort to function in the role. It also means to me, when I sustain a person, that I will accept from that person any reasonable and legitimate demand that person makes on me in his or her role in the church, whether that role is a teacher or a primary president or a Sunday school president. If that person comes to me in that capacity and asks me to do something, perform well or do a better job, and I'm able to respond, I will do that, because I think that sustaining that person means that that's one of the things that I will do. I think in general, when I sustain a person, it also means that I will do otherwise about everything one can think of that will be possible and reasonable to facilitate that person's success in that calling. And that sometimes means criticizing the person privately. I feel very much entitled to do that, and I don't care who the is. I feel entitled when I think that some error has been committed to seek that person out privately and in a spirit of meekness and love to make known my my criticism and to do what I can to help set the situation right if the person I've criticized is willing to concede that an error has been committed. And if that person's not willing, then I just forgive him or her anyway and go on about my business. But I feel obliged as part of what it means to me to sustain that person to let the person know that he or she has screwed up, in my opinion. And preferably to let that person know about that before the screw-up becomes worse, which is often the case if you don't get in on a problem early. I think it means that when a person has screwed up, if you'll forgive my slang, and believe me, priesthood leaders do screw up, and you didn't need to be told that, when that happens, then I have the responsibility also to forgive that person and to reassure that person as much as I can, again, privately, when I think an error has been committed. I think our leaders and our teachers, from top to bottom, need our love and forgiveness and reassurance most of all when they have screwed up. And the worse the screw-up, the more they need it. And so I think it's a sad and terrible thing when we find a person in a leadership or teaching position who has got himself or herself into a predicament through their own stupidity, that we stand back and all we do is carp and criticize and complain. That's not sustaining a person. What happens when we do that to the old adage that there but for the grace of God, you know, go I. We need to give them our forgiveness and help precisely when they are the most in error, because that is when they are the most vulnerable. I think sustaining to me also means that I do my best when I pick up rumors, recriminations, or whatever about a person in the ward or the stake or the general authorities, that I do my best to try to slow that rumor down or to stop it rather than amplify it, which is the kind of normal attempt or normal tendency, and send it on in bigger and better shape to the next person. I think that we shouldn't do that. That is not sustaining a person. Even if we have some reason to believe that the rumor or recrimination is valid, I think that it is our responsibility not to make things worse or to pass on something, but to see what we can do to slow it down or stamp it out, or to suggest an alternative interpretation of the same kind of incident that has been so grievously interpreted by the person speaking to us. Now, those are all the things that it means to me when I raise my hand to sustain a person, or when I continue to sustain a person in ordinary church life. Now, there are a few problems. First, there are some common presumptions about the meaning of sustain that I don't share. And I consider this problematic because I fear, from my experience in the church, that a lot of these presumptions are widely believed and widely shared, and it's a problem for me because I don't share them. One is that sustaining a leader means that you obey that leader no matter what. I think we're all beyond that, but it has not been more than a few weeks since a young man reported to me that a member of his stake presidency stood up and publicly said that if the stake president told him tomorrow to change the color of his house paint, he would repaint his house. And I can't imagine a grown-up saying something like that in public without embarrassment. But a member of a stake presidency, apparently, on the information of my friend in Longview, Washington, did publicly say something like that. I don't buy that, and I don't think many of you do. Sustain to me does not mean to endure impositions indefinitely from a person just because he or she is a church leader. For example, maybe the first couple of times I'm called to a meeting on a day's notice, I might show up. But the next time, and when I do show up, I'm going to make it known that I think I was entitled to more notice. And maybe the third time I'm invited to a meeting on one day's notice that the leaders have known about for a month, I won't go. Not just out of obstinacy, but I mean, if I have something else that is important to do, I won't give the priority to my church obligation or my church meeting that I would have if I had been shown the courtesy of a little bit of advance notice. Now, there are a lot of other ways that people in leadership positions impose on the saints. And I think we are obliged to endure some of those impositions for a while, not silently and not indefinitely. So sustaining to me doesn't mean, you know, just taking whatever is handed out indefinitely. I don't think sustaining means never offering any critical comments, but I think we should offer our criticisms in private. And that's just basic courtesy, isn't it? None of us likes to be criticized in public. What makes us think bishops do or general authorities do? Of course they don't. We should do our best to get to them privately, if they'll let us. There's one more set of problems that I'd like to refer to that I think complicate the whole issue of sustaining. One is the short history of the church, relatively short history of the church, combined with the fact of our lay ministry. Now, in many ways, of course, both of these are strengths to our organization. We haven't been an organization long enough to become a thoroughly ossified and crystallized bureaucracy. You know, we're obviously headed that way, but we haven't had the time really yet to do that. It's hard maybe for younger people to appreciate what a difference has occurred in only one generation in the extent and degree of the bureaucratization of the church. It certainly began well before the so-called correlation movement. Correlation has certainly intensified it, but we have only begun to enter the kind of bureaucratization that, say, the Roman Catholic Church has had for centuries. Similarly, our lay ministry is often considered one of our strengths, but there's a downside to the lay ministry, especially when combined with the relatively short history of our bureaucratization. And that is, again, unlike the Catholic Church, we have no tradition of canon law. We have no carefully spelled out arrangements and limits that determine what's legitimate and not legitimate for a priesthood leader to do. There's a lot of ambiguity about that. I expect, though I may not live to see it, the evolution ultimately of some sort of body that would be comparable to Catholic canon law. At the moment, we don't have it. That's where a lot of our difficulty comes from, is the ambiguity. That's why a lot of what church leaders at all levels do sometimes seems so capricious, because there is not a clearly understood set of limits and constraints on what they can do. What seems perfectly illegitimate to some one person might seem quite legitimate to another. Take the example that I think is a real live true example of changing the color of your house paint. We can probably all think of extreme examples where we would object on grounds of legitimacy. I mean, not too many of us would commit suicide if we were ordered to do so by a priesthood leader. Although, I don't know, I've even heard people a couple of times in my lifetime say they would do that. But I don't think that at that extremity that we often have much of a problem. It's really more in the middle of this continuum between the obviously legitimate and the obviously illegitimate that we run into the ambiguity. What does a priesthood leader have the right to demand of us as a priesthood leader? Or for that matter, a teacher have a right to demand of us as a teacher? We are not clear about that. We have a lot of difference of opinion. And so a lot of the trouble and ambiguity and pain over what it means to sustain somebody comes from the fact that we haven't agreed on what is a legitimate request or demand of that person in which he or she should be sustained. And it's going to be a while before we get there. Unaccustomed as I am to brevity, I think that's about all I can think of to say. Thank you very much.
sustaining and approving have always been considered to be vital in the Mormon Church. Even the Book of Commandments, considered to be revelation from God, had to be approved by a vote of the congregation before it became officially binding. Of the many references in the present Doctrine and Covenants concerning the necessity for doing things in the church by common consent, I find two of special interest. Doctrine and Covenants 38:34, quote, "And now I give unto the church in these parts a commandment, that certain men among them shall be appointed, and they shall be appointed by the voice of the church." And the second, Doctrine and Covenants 124:144, "And a commandment I give unto you, that you should fill all these offices and approve of these names which I have mentioned, or else disapprove of them at my general conference." I find these references interesting in that first, the appointment is by the voice of the church, which indicates that the ratification of the congregation is an integral part of the appointment process, and second, that approving or disapproving of the names appears to be a normal option offered by the Lord in whose name the commandment was given. There is no hint here that one's choice is to be constrained, except by common sense and the normal consideration one has for fellow human beings. Encouragement, almost insistence upon active participation by individuals in the decision-making process, is also given by Brigham Young. Quote, "Some may say, 'Brethren, you who lead the church, we have all confidence in you. We are not in the least afraid, but what everything will go right under your superintendence.' I do not wish any Latter-day Saint in this world or in heaven to be satisfied with anything I do unless the Spirit of the Lord Jesus Christ, the Salvation, makes them satisfied. I am fearful that they settle down in a state of blind self-security, trusting their eternal destiny in the hands of their leaders with a reckless confidence that in itself would thwart the purposes of God in their salvation and weaken the influence they could give their leaders." If I read this correctly, three things are implied. One, that individuals are responsible for their own salvation. Otherwise, there would be no danger in trusting their eternal destiny in the hands of their leaders. Two, that leaders are capable of error. If there were not, there would again be no danger in entrusting one's eternal destiny in their hands. And three, that individuals can and should influence their leaders. Implicit in Brigham Young's words is the concept that if the spirit of revelation does not make them satisfied with what their leaders do, individuals should let them know. There appear at present to be very few opportunities to do this. For the most part, attempts to let anyone in high authority know of dissatisfaction are short-circuited back to the local stake presidency and never seen by the authority. Possibly this is a problem of bureaucracy and not of intent, but the effect is, in Brigham Young's words, to weaken the influence that might be given the leaders. The only way of exercising any influence left the member is in the vote to sustain or not to sustain. In view of the major roadblocks in place, every eye of the congregation among him or on him or her, gaining a reputation as a dissenter and a disruptor, the very election act, it is not surprising that an opposing voice is rarely cast. The vote itself, stripped of its meaning, becomes an automatic gesture. Yet this should not be. In 1947, then-Apostle John A. Witzo said, quote, "Every person may vote freely for or against a name, and should do so according to his convictions. The voting is not a perfunctory act, but one of great importance." Some past authorities, of course, have tried to cajole members into taking more seriously their right and obligation to participate in church decision-making. J. Golden Kimball is said to have once proposed that Mount Nebo may be moved across Utah Lake. According to Mormon folklore, the motion passed without a dissenting vote. I was present in August of 1985 when the late Bishop Stephen Christensen told a Sunstone Symposium audience that he had given his ward members a third alternative in the sustaining vote. To "all those in favor, please signify, all opposed by the same sign," he had added, "all those who don't give a damn." In justice To those members in attendance at the average meeting where ward business takes place, the young husband and father may have just bent over to pick up the hymn book which his five-year-old has just dropped. His wife may be trying to poke Cheerios into the mouth of the 10-month-old who has just decided to fuss. And the 3-year-old may have just whispered in mother's ear that she needs the bathroom. Grandpa sitting next to the 3-year-old and who has forgotten his hearing aid may be about to doze off. Suddenly, all adults become aware that someone has been proposed for something, and all hands go up. It is a triumph of faith in their leadership, because for all they really know, they have just approved Genghis Khan as ward clerk. It is to be noted that all this has taken place with good intentions all around. Compounding the logistical problems described above, there seems unhappily to have been increased pressure from some in authority, appearing to suggest that people really don't need to trouble their heads about the problem of sustaining at all. All they really need to do is raise their hands. In April conference of 1972, a general authority gave the following advice, quote, "If for any reason we have a difficult time sustaining those in office, then we are to go to our local priesthood leaders and discuss the issue with them and seek their help." A 1974 statement by a Brigham Young University professor of religion reiterates the general authority statement about the nonconformist needing help. Why? Because he has placed himself in opposition to those who have been called to positions of responsibility in the Lord's Church. This statement ignores the DNC admonition previously quoted, which indicates that the right to vote negatively or positively is an integral part of the sustaining process. If, as I suspect, the integrity of the sustaining process has been compromised, what, if anything, can be done about it? In discussing this point with a family member, the suggestion was made that on a local level, some of the proposals for staffing or change could be made on a given Sunday to be voted on the Sunday following, with the invitation given to the ward members to confer with the bishopric as to problems or suggestions. In this way, private concerns and reservations could be addressed and or malice could be diffused without a public confrontation. In addition, the members would more truly be part of the decision-making process. To sustain the general authorities is a separate matter. At this point, I should probably explore what it means to sustain, my definition of what it is, and what I think it is not. Until now, I've been considering sustaining in the narrow sense of the act of voting for a suggested office or option. Obviously, we use the term in a much broader sense. Of the 9 major entries in my Webster's unabridged dictionary listing under sustain, and see, I'm doing what you told me that I would do if I weren't using my imagination. These listed under sustain, I find 3 to reflect aspects of what I conceive to be a Latter-day Saint definition: to strengthen the spirit's courage, etc., of, to comfort, to buoy up, encourage, to uphold or support the validity or justice of, to confirm, prove, or corroborate. Occasionally, I use one that I have developed a slang definition for, and that is to put up with. To sustain involves loyalty, obedience, and respect, even reverence, but none of these in a totally unqualified form. Always there must be the recourse to conscience. Otherwise, one becomes an idolater, showing excessive veneration for a person so as to follow as a deity one who is not God. The consequence of deifying those in authority and who hold priesthood power may be that in emphasizing the power, we blind ourselves to the scriptural reassurance that priesthood power can be ephemeral. Misused in unrighteous dominion, it disappears. And to paraphrase Macbeth, it may be full of sound and fury, and while it may provoke great dismay, it may signify nothing in eternal consequences. After all, other men already walk the earth exercising what they believe to be priesthood power. power which, according to LDS doctrine, they really do not have due to apostasy. While unrighteous dominion is a judgment call reserved for God, if any authorities do in fact exercise it, they make of themselves stumbling blocks, not facilitators in God's plan. A friend of mine once asked a general authority what she should do if he asked her to do something which violated her conscience. The reply was that she might have to act against her conscience. She wondered what consciences were for. Perhaps that what the general authority meant was that there is a kind of collective or corporate conscience made up of what has been gleaned by following the brethren and internalizing official definitions of what constitutes right and wrong, virtue and sin, and that that collective conscience should supersede and even replace the personal and private conscience. I do not know if that is what the general authority meant, but the notion that it might be troubles me. I suspect what we are really dealing with is the tension between the demands of the institutional church and the imperatives of free and individual agency. I have found no better description of these tensions than that given by the B.H. Roberts Society to introduce a series of lectures exploring relations between the institutional church and the individual. Quote, "A central purpose of mortality is to allow individual growth through the exercise of free agency. A central purpose of institutions generally is to maintain themselves with a minimum of disorder. Individual free agency, in its purest form, implies the existence of unlimited choice. Institutions, on the other hand, require a certain level of conformity in order to preserve their identity." End of quote. For those of us who lean to the free agency side of the equation, the question we must confront is that which was posed by Professor Helmut Pfister, quoted by Elaine Pagels in her National Book Award winning The Gnostic Gospels. And this is the question, is our approach, quote, "able to build a church rather than a club or a school, a sect, or merely a series of concerned religious individuals," end of quote. Yet much of Joseph Smith's thinking is on the side of free agency. He took literally the biblical admonition, to ask, and he did receive, alone and individually. He refused to establish a pattern of orthodox belief for Latter-day Saints. Although a student of the Bible, Joseph said, "I have the oldest book in my heart, even the Holy Ghost." This mystical side of Joseph Smith has a special resonance for some of us, and we are disturbed when we still hear quoted the following, although it was repudiated as long ago as 1945, soon after its publication. Quote, "When our leaders speak, the thinking has been done. When they give direction, it should mark the end of controversy." This appeared as a teacher message in the Improvement Era, June of 1945. Then President George Albert Smith said in part, "Even to imply that members of the church are not to do their own thinking is grossly to misrepresent the true ideal of the church, which is that every individual must obtain for himself a testimony of the truth of the gospel, must through the redemption of Jesus Christ work out his own salvation, and is personally responsible to his Maker for his individual acts." President Smith continues, "The Prophet Joseph once said, 'I want the liberty of thinking and believing as I please.' This liberty, he and his successors in the leadership of the church have granted to every other member thereof." End of quote. For all of us and all other religious persons, the imperative is to constantly ponder, in Pagel's words, the question of what is the proper relation between the authority of one's own experience and that claimed for the scripture, the ritual, and the clergy.
We have a half hour, I believe, and we would like to hear from you. Since this is being tape recorded, it is essential that somehow we get it on the tape. How is best to do that? Have you come forward or... All right. You got questions for whom? Go ahead.
I've never heard any of you address why we do it. I mean, what's the purpose of doing it today? Maybe there's a purpose of some kind. But in my experience in the church in my lifetime, there's never been a purpose of sustaining or raising your hand.
The question is, why do we do it? Do you address that to any one of our panelists? Well, for me, it is the legitimating process that says here's authority, and that that badge of authority is something that I recognize, and the way I make that recognition publicly is to bring my hand forward and say, I support, I sustain. And what that means for me, really, is that if the Deacon's Quorum President comes to me and says, Gene Shoemaker, I would like you to help pass the sacrament, having sustained that person, I have no right to refuse. Panel? Go ahead, yes.
I just had a couple of thoughts on that. In practice, one of the functions is that it gives me something to get my kids to do and get their attention in church. But personally, I guess I take that seriously. To me, it's a kind of act of conscience, a kind of something. I feel like I'm saying something, and it's like there's a passage in A Man for All Seasons where I think Sir Thomas More says that when you break an oath, it's like you put yourself in your hands, and if you break it, you let your fingers open and yourself spills out and you'll never find it again. I may be putting too much weight on it, but it's a kind of affirmation that I feel I'm making, even silently, by that act. On this question of things being maybe perfunctory, I think that is often true. I'm on a high council where we, if you know anything about that, there's a lot of approving of names that goes on, and our stake presidency is trying to make that less perfunctory. The problem is that things come up the last minute and people don't have adequate information and all this. And so we just hear the name and we say, well, okay, whoever that is. And they're trying to get us to provide more information, to give some sense of the person, to, you know, so that we really are, it's more of a thoughtful thing, but it is a challenge.
Well, I think that
as you posed the question, it occurred to me that there is a historical reason for it, of course, in that it's provided in the Doctrine and Covenants that these things be done by common consent. And I suppose that what you're addressing is the apparent fact that it's so perfunctory that it really has no significance. I would invite you to make a comparison with saluting the flag. I can't see that has any operational function whatsoever. And each person who does it maybe does it for a somewhat different reason. And how perfunctory saluting the flag is to you is entirely for you to determine, or for me. And I think when we raise our hand to sustain leaders, it's a little bit like that. It can be very perfunctory, meaning absolutely nothing. On the other hand, it might be profoundly significant to the person. We have a lot of rituals in society and elsewhere that are quite perfunctory.
I feel that it is, even though it's difficult, sometimes even impossible, and incredibly wieldy, to give some thought to this sustaining vote. It's part of almost a covenant relationship. That is the affirmation that we do, in fact, sustain. Not absolutely, not whatever they do or anything else. But if this is not so, and we don't take it seriously, then we will end up with the Church of Latter-day Leaders and not the Church of Latter-day Saints. And I think there's a difference.
I'm not sure I fully understand your problem here. It has to do with how does one at the local level reach those at the highest level when you have a criticism or you have a legitimate complaint? You point a real dilemma in the church, because judgment is not ours to make. And in most instances, and the hierarchy within the church is that if you have a problem with anyone at the top or above, that will be referred back to the local level for resolution. That's you don't have access to the Quorum of the Twelve on any issue that you may choose to bring to their attention. No, I think their legitimacy rests upon the fact that they've been called by revelation.
Well, then they can't make a mistake.
How's that? No, it doesn't mean that at all. It means that those who have the keys to make those calls have made the call. And the congregations at various levels are asked to support and sustain that call.
I think their legitimacy depends upon two things. One, that they have been called by legitimate authority, and two, that they have been sustained by the saints. I think if either of those things didn't happen, their calls would not be legitimate.
Could they be exercising an unrighteous dominion by
Well, I think you have to specify the case, but I certainly do think that some of the initiatives that I have learned about that have come from the general authorities, I would regard as unrighteous dominion and illegitimate initiatives. Yeah. Oh, we've got a lawyer back there, Paul, that really wants to...
It seems to me that on the precedent that the Book of Commandments, which presumably reflected the commandments given by God to Joseph Smith, still had to be ratified by the congregation before the transaction was complete and this became official. It seems to me that in that same reasoning, certainly somebody's appointment, and the quotations that I read, I realize that you can take any quotation out of context and have it mean almost anything. But if a confirming vote is anything at all, then it means that the transaction is not complete until that confirming vote has been taken. At least that's the logic I see in it. And that's what I see when I read back through church history, through those early transactions. They were pretty stormy. They didn't seem to be particularly perfunctory. And as I recall, and I can't tell you where I found this, even Joseph Smith himself had been called into account on a couple of occasions.
Could I just add to that? In my comparison to the flag salute, I was really referring to the perfunctory parallel. Yeah, but I don't know that. I would define that what we do when we sustain people, even if we do it perfunctorily, that it's the equivalent to loyalty oath. Any more than if I go to a meeting of the faculty senate or something, and which is being operated by Robert's Rules of Order, and I'm asked to vote yay or nay, I don't take that as a test of my loyalty to this organization that I belong to. For doing what?
Voting the name of the state conference against the brethren in the 12.
Well, I don't know that.
Independence right here.
Well, I don't know. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, I'm taking your word for it because I don't know any of those details. But to the extent that that's true, then I would say that this is a misuse of the whole sustaining process and a misinterpretation of what it means for us to raise our hand in a sustaining vote. I don't take it as a loyalty oath. I would just take it if I agreed or disagreed with an action. So, but I can see where Paul might be right in a practical operational sense that that's what we've gotten to as a church, and that's just a damn shame. But I think that if anybody's going to do something about it, we're going to have to do something about it. I have, in the last 5 years, on three different occasions, I have seen hands raised against setting apart of a person in a state presidency or high council. I haven't seen anybody oppose general authorities, but I have seen opposition. And as far as I could, have been able to determine, there have never been any consequences. The person who thus raised his hand, it was a man in all three cases, a different man, was taken aside. The state president actually said that, well, we'll delay this, the decision on this. And that person was not sustained, and it came up again at another conference. That's the way it's supposed to operate, as I understand it, but I know it doesn't always operate, and I'm as distressed as Paul or and some of the others of you are at the perfunctory nature that we have come to on this. It's unnecessary.
I had a thought here, too, partly because if I figured out the identifying of people up here, I must be one of the ones who has been identified as believing that it's a loyalty oath, and I wanted to correct that impression, because I don't think that's what I intended. I think what I intended to say is that I feel there is a kind of sustaining covenant that I am freely participating in when I raise my hand, and that it is intended to be one of support, of loyalty in every positive sense. That is, that I want to be for that person, not against them. As far as how perfunctory it is, I think that, as was said a little bit earlier, it really depends on each of us, and maybe we need to look at ourselves first. But as far as whether the scriptures simply are saying, oh, it's just kind of a vote, yes or no, I think, and I'd have to look at it. I'd have to look at the scriptures, ponder them, see exactly what is said in various places, but at least two or three other things occur to me that give me a different impression. One is the idea that the Lord asks that the saints accept Joseph Smith in all patience and faith. That sounds like something a bit more positive and sustaining than simply, you know, do I like him or not? The other is, I'd have to look it up and see if it's really there, but I seem to remember, on the one hand, that there's something in the Doctrine and Covenants about the possibility that Joseph Smith could lose his calling if he fell into transgression. On the other hand, I think there's something, and I have to check this too, that suggests that that the church, by not accepting Joseph Smith, could fall into transgression and no longer be the Lord's church. So I'm just saying that I think there's some scriptural evidence that it's something more than just a kind of do I like the guy or not? There are some other dynamics going on.
Yeah.
Well, I think there are various angles you could look at this from. One is that the fact that it's in a temple recommend interview as well as the sort of thing we raise our hand for doesn't necessarily mean that we can logically determine that we must be dealing with two different things. You know, there are other ways you could look at it. It could be a renewing of that sustaining we've already done. You also seem to, well, I'm guessing here that there may be something of this question that was brought up a moment ago. Maybe they don't have authority until we sustain them, and so we shouldn't be maybe required to say that we're going to sustain them beforehand. But I guess that's not how I hear the temple recommend question. I hear it as saying those who are now in authority, because they have been sustained by the church and presumably by me, do I reaffirm that that is my attitude? And I think you could make an argument that though there are these moments of decision at which things could go one way or the other, that before and after that, it is one of the duties of a Latter-day Saint to sustain the leaders, not in the extreme or absolute ways that have been suggested as being illegitimate, but in the positive ways we've been talking about. Well, I think I do. If I don't, when I've said something, if I don't match that in what I say, challenge me again. Part of it is simply the connotation of that phrase, loyalty oath, as if this is something with cameras at every corner of the building looking down and seeing whether I have raised my hand for yes or no. I'm being tested, you know, and all of that. It does involve loyalty, because I'm talking about what my attitude is towards people. And when I raise my hand, I intend that. And I freely intend that to be an expression of loyalty. But if I were to vote no, which I can conceive maybe there might be. My wife and I were. We had a recent change in the bishopric, and my wife and I were talking about who we would, who in the world we might not sustain if they were presented. And there were two or three that we came up with. I don't think. Now, you know, I'd always have to deal with the whim of whoever maybe would be in authority there if I did vote no. But I would believe, this is my attitude, that if I voted no, but that nevertheless others sustained the person, and the person was or set apart by established authority, I believe that I should then sustain and support that person.
But you don't feel yeah. You would have been disloyal to raise your hand.
Not at that moment, no.
No.
Not that alone. That comes in the category of what I call major screw-up. You know, if we start withholding our sustaining vote for people who do stupid things in office, then we won't have anybody sustain. And it also gets back to my understanding of the Mormon way of revelation, which to me always begins with the initiative of the individual. When they've bought some phony documents, that doesn't mean to me that they didn't that they didn't get revelation and therefore they can't get revelation, or that God doesn't speak to them. What it means to me is they didn't go and ask. And as I understand the Mormon way of revelation, the way it starts is somebody goes and asks, and then there's a response. If you don't go and ask, then you're certainly not going to get any revelation. And so while I accept hypothetically that the church is led and guided by revelation, as an operational matter, in my experience, most of the actions taken by most church leaders are not inspired by revelation. They're cost-benefit calculations that represent human judgment, including a lot of human error. I wish we had a lot more revelation in the church than we have. I think it's there to have access to. But I think that the farther away we get from those early charismatic days, the less we have resort to it at all levels. But I don't think that's the same thing at all as whether a person has legitimately been called and installed.
Yeah, I have a question for Armin before you. Yes. The point that's being made, is there anything wrong with adopting that notion?
No, I don't think there is. And I meant, at least I thought implicitly, in what I laid out as what it meant to me when I said I sustained somebody, was the various kinds of responses that I give when confronted with concrete situations. And so, yeah, I see that distinction, and I think it's a legitimate distinction. And while I didn't have in mind the hypothetical case that you just laid down, where you might actually vote against somebody in state conference when it comes to sustaining in that sense, that you would then still comply with that person's or recognize that person's authority. Yeah, I think that's a very important distinction.
One more.
I certainly don't pose as an authority on this, but from my reading of our scriptures, the system is in place. It calls for not conditional agency, not unconditional agency, and certainly not unconditional authority. That is to say that we cannot impose on each other's roles in this. There's a tension between authority and agency. There's a tension between leadership and membership. And as long as we keep that in balance, it keeps both sides of the equation in order. If this breaks down, and I think a means by which it can easily break down is for communication to break down. If there's no way that the membership, for example, has access to voice their concerns, then you've got a problem. And in our doctrine, we certainly have what happens to priesthood power if it's abused. I think the system is there. Whether it's fully operational on either side of the equation at all times, I think, is the question we must ask. I think we have the mechanisms, but we have to have the personal responsibility to use these mechanisms.
There was a gentleman here that, excuse me,
Sam Taylor, right?
I want to thank the panel. I want to thank each of you for your participation. It's been a good session.